Welcome to the Digitally Sick podcast.
Hi everyone, and welcome to another edition of Digitally Sick. We have a special edition today. Is that the right term? Special edition?
Special guests.
Well, we have special guests. Yeah, one of a special edition. Anyway, in the pod, we have the normal team. So me, Alex Butler, Faisal.
Here. Hiya, how you doing?
I'm good. And Kai as well.
Hello.
And beamed in by the miracle of technology, we have John and Joe. So you guys, introduce yourselves and tell us where you are.
Hi, everybody. My name is John Cairns. I'm based here in Singapore for Sanofi. So I lead multi-channel and digital innovation for the emerging Asian markets.
Great. Joe?
Hi, everyone. My name is Joe. I'm based out of India, and I head digital innovation, focusing especially on diabetes for Sanofi.
Fantastic. Well, thanks for joining us, guys. I mean, it's not too bad an hour, actually, where you both are, is it? But, I think there's a 2 and 3.5 hour difference to Mumbai? I didn't know there was anywhere with half an hour time differences, but you learn something new. So, guys, thanks for joining us. Basically, today we're going to be talking about digital health in Asia, essentially, which is incredibly exciting. Asia is a continent, incredibly exciting, fast-growing, and incredibly important to the future of healthcare and the future of digital health. So would you mind just giving us an idea of what you actually do? Obviously, you've got your title, but what does that actually mean in reality on a day-to-day basis? Joe, do you want to go first?
Sure. So just to give you a little bit of background, so my current role is mostly focusing to work with the diabetes teams with Sanofi in India to understand how the patient and doctor behavior is changing in India. How do we evolve with this changing behavior? What are the new tools and resources do we deploy? What are the new kind of partnerships we should explore so that we can become more new age in terms of engaging both the patients and the doctors in India. So that's my role, and it's quite exciting to do this role, especially in a time like this in India, because I think there's a lot of innovation happening. Mm-hmm. So it's very exciting.
Yeah, and we'll delve into that, because obviously it's a massive country and a fascinating country, so it'd be good to talk about that in a bit more detail. And John, what about yourself?
So I cover kind of a similar role, but it's very much at the Asia region level. So Asia region in Sanofi is everywhere from kind of Bangladesh, India, you know, Thailand, Malaysia, Singapore, Philippines, Vietnam, Hong Kong, Taiwan. So those are the markets we cover. And it's, again, a very similar thing. We look to really drive innovation and change around our business models, our solutions for patients, really thing we're passionate about is what we call integrated care. So really looking for solutions from kind of beginning to end to, I would say, that kind of address multiple pain points that the patients have or the healthcare system, you know, around things like access, wellness, and really looking at things like adherence too. So yeah, we obviously a key part of that, which I'm very keen on, is how we integrate ourselves with the health tech ecosystem that kind of exists across Asia, because it is extremely rich.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So a really quick and easy question. What are the broad trends for pharma and digital across the whole of Asia? I'm joking, but I suppose the point you made there, John, is an important point, in that anyone that knows anything about Asia knows that the countries that you described are all incredibly different. Well, not all different to each other, but there is a massive difference and a range there. So what actually do you see as the trends, or, you know, what binds these places together, and what's different with regard to the market types? I suppose, you know, you'd call it maybe mature versus emerging, whether you like that term or not. But, you know, how do you frame it up when you know you're speaking to people about it?
Yeah, I'm not too sure that the words emerging and emerged are always the best labels to have. I mean,
I think it's
kind of how we define ourselves corporately, I guess. But if you look in emerging Asia, there are lots of different types of markets. You know, you probably see everything from what you see in Europe around reimbursed markets to markets which are, you know, there's a lot more insurance, or there's lots more self pay for patients and things like this. So you see a real diverse I think some of the broad trends are actually quite mind-boggling around growth in Asia. Mm-hmm. So even before we get into health tech, if you think about it, Asia has around over 4 billion people in it, of which still 55% are only online. I was doing some homework just before the podcast. And if you think about it, 50% of the world's internet usage comes from this region, which includes, you know, the most populous nations, China and India, are the top two markets globally for internet usage. And obviously, internet usage is extremely different, I would say, than Europe. You know, you see a lot of voice search out here. Over 50% of people using internet in India and trying to use voice search. Mobile. I mean, recently I was in a hospital in India. You know, you walk through, you have a look into the doctor's office. You don't see PCs. You only see mobile phones. So solutions are very, very different. How they manage patients can be extraordinarily different. But when it comes really down to health tech, you start to see three main centers around the region emerge, which is basically China, Singapore, and India in terms of health tech. There's roughly 3,000-4,000 health tech startups across the region. If you look at the type of funding, I mean, my friends at Gale and Growth do a lot of mapping. We sit on their health tech council to try and understand and map what's going on out there to see what the opportunities are. And they're a little bit like Rock Health in the US. So funding levels are around about, for the first half this year, $2.5 billion done in deals. Last year, I think it was, over $6 billion done, $8 billion done in the US. It's the second biggest ecosystem in the world. China equates for most of it, $5.5 billion in terms of deals. India is second in terms of $560 million. But that said, there's way more startups and health tech in India than there is in China. And lastly comes really Singapore. And Singapore is a great hub for what we call the ASEAN markets, so like Southeast Asia. So there's some very favorable conditions, I would say, for startups in Singapore to prosper. The government have been quite friendly and have been very proactive in attracting investment into Singapore, but startups and health tech in Singapore tends to serve the markets which sit around it. So, you know, Thailand, Malaysia, Philippines, Vietnam, these types of things as well. So you start to see this whole dichotomy unfold. But Asia is growing massively. I was reading just now here that, you know, internet usage has grown almost 11,000% in the region since 2000. Contrast that with the UK, which is 311%, you start to feel the growth. And I think the biggest point to make is still we only have 55% people online. There is huge, huge potential still going forward.
It's amazing numbers, isn't it?
It is, yeah. I mean, you know, stats are really useful to give a picture, but I suppose the important thing is practically what happens, how that translates.
But even down to practical, John, what's the, John and Joe, what's the coverage for mobile over there? Is it 4G? 5G everywhere?
Yeah, at least in India, you see 4G available in most of the top cities and towns. It's either 4G or 3G. As you go into rural today, 3G is readily available. In some areas, if you go further into villages, etc., probably 2G and 3G. But in the major towns that you see where internet penetration has happened, 4G.
Amazing.
And I think that's quite consistent with government. I mean governments like in the Indonesian government's been quite proactive in making 4G available. I mean, if you think of Indonesia, 17,000 islands and how they connect them together, it's 4G. And I think by the end of this year, they had a policy where they're trying to implement. I don't know where they are with it, but there was a commitment to take 4G across the entire nation. So, yeah, I mean, governments are pushing it. That said, infrastructure is still an issue in some markets, in some places around Asia, you know, Philippines, Vietnam, there are still some, I would say, infrastructure challenges around 3 and 4G, but predominantly it is getting there.
What would you say, moving away from the numbers, that the major health challenges are that the use of this technology might be able to help? Because you mentioned, and it's something that I've seen myself, that in places where maybe it was a slower adoption of earlier technology, there's a leapfrog effect where, for instance, you don't need a, like, you know, a desktop PC, like, you know, in the UK, people are trapped with old machines, and you can just use your mobile, you can use your tablet.
Well, it's like the doctors all on mobile, like John said earlier.
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly.
It's massive.
But moving away from the stats, what are the actual health challenges that you think digital health could possibly impact? So, you know, in India for Joe and obviously John for you across Asia.
So in India, the way we see it, there are three major things. First is access, because the doctor to patient ratio in India is not that great. Yeah. The access to hospitals and infrastructure in general, if I consider India as a whole, is pretty different, because you have access to healthcare in the top tier cities and metro cities. But as you go more into deeper India, I don't think you have access to healthcare. The second is cost and quality. India is a pay out of pocket market. So when someone's paying out of pocket, it becomes a very different entity, and they would want to negotiate on the pricing. They don't feel comfortable with the pricing. They don't want to go up for a follow-up visit. They don't want to fill up their prescription for the next month because it's mostly out of pay. You see adherence issues, you see quality issues, you see other issues happening. And both of them are being managed by technology today. You see more and more technology come into the market, which is solving for access, which is solving for cost and quality, and which is also solving for the third thing, which is continuum of care. Because it is an out-of-pay market, there is a lot of adherence issues to treatment protocols. We see health tech playing a significant role in providing the continuum of care in India.
And what about yourself, John, for the rest of the Asia region?
Yeah, I think to build on Joe's point, I think in China, I see some very similarities to what Joe described. So distribution of healthcare is a real issue. If you think of the policies of the government, you know, where they're trying to promote universal health coverage, I think it's almost at 100% now. But if you think about, you know, what that actually really means is even basic access to treatment and diagnosis is one thing. So you start to see a lot of solutions from people like Ping and Doctor trying to answer for that. You see the rise of internet hospitals, which try to get from diagnosis through to fulfillment. And I remember when I lived in China, you know, visiting hospitals as part of my role, you know, you would see in the hospitals, you would see, you know, basically a lot of people spilling over, particularly with those hospitals that were highly rated. So you saw the trust levels between different institutions vary, and the trust levels between doctors vary as well. And I think one other issue which you find in some systems out here in Asia is continuity of care as well, and how a patient might be managed across, you know, particularly in chronic diseases, how they're actually managed. So actually not seeing the same person on a regular basis in a hospital like Vietnam or in China, and being able to manage, you know, whatever chronic conditions that you have across a period of time. So you start to see solutions like this, you know, EMR records and things like this, and solutions to kind of keep that as well. So yeah, I think you start to see a lot of this, a lot of these things try to access these problems. As well as that, you kind of see, I would say, how do you kind of scale this? And this is interesting as well, because you get pharma involved in this, but you also see insurance playing a key role to access here and scale as well. I would say that health tech, certainly in Asia, desires and looks for this. Yes, they're trying to solve problems, but they're also trying to scale. So you start to see some incredible numbers in terms of, you know, the reach and how far these solutions will actually go. So you start to see some very big providers come. So in the case of China, you hear the normal names, you know, you hear Tencent, you hear Alibaba, you hear Baidu, and the government are very much looking to these guys to kind of solve these kind of problems.
So when working across kind of broad healthcare strategy in Europe, which I've done a bit in digital health for the EU, won't be doing that in the future, I don't think, unfortunately, as we decide to leave Europe. But you know, there was a common theme across Europe, which was the challenges that people face with things like health inequalities, access to medicine or access to healthcare generally, chronic disease and cancer, I assume that there's similar things where you guys are, but for example, John, looking at, you know, for instance, the challenges in China, the World Health Organization basically put warnings up that, you know, China faces massively increased rates of cancer and cardiovascular disease coming up to 2030. So just looking at those two things, and add other things in if you think that, you know, they're also relevant. Do you think that the technology, getting away from the spearhead stuff, like you said, like the AI, you know, work that's going on and all the stuff that's going on at the high end of tech, with regard to the mass population, do you think that digital health is going to actually offer some real solutions for people?
I think in many ways, Alex, I think it already is. And I think if you look at some of the kind of big players in China, you know, people are using platforms already for health diagnosis and actually communicating with doctors and institutions online. So WeChat's an obvious big platform, but it is leveraged by most, a lot of institutions and doctors for that. And obviously with the prevalence of mobile devices, then people can access these services. I guess the tricky piece comes really into, you know, are there enough people to service these channels and are there enough people to service these technologies? So I don't think it's just a tech issue. It's obviously the inertia in the system around how do you make these solutions, you know, viable and kind of workable. You know, I think we often have this idealistic view of a patient journey. You know, you hear this a lot, but actually, you know, what does a healthcare professional really matter in a patient journey? Are they just trying to solve a particular problem within it? So, you know, again, some of these solutions will address some of the pain points. I think, Alex, it has started to have some impact. I think Ping and Doctor, for example, have made some really big strides into what we used to call telehealth, you know, online consultation, this type of thing.
Yeah, and I suppose the point that always comes to me when it got to this kind of discussion in, say, large... I also don't like the term emerging market, I agree with you, but where you've got massive issues, societal issues, you know, geographic issues, is that often the focus in digital health is on giving people access to healthcare professionals or diagnostics, but actually the biggest problem is often access to medicine or access to high quality care. And obviously digital health can improve through interventions, outcomes, clinical and patient outcomes, but obviously the challenge is massive, isn't it? I mean, Joe, in India, I know that amazing stuff is going on, but I'll ask the same question of you, because I know that there's big challenges with regard to how much money is actually spent on healthcare, the divide between urban and rural centres, poor health infrastructure. I know that obviously because of the divide in the socioeconomic divide is low levels of health insurance and preventative care is a challenge. So I've thrown lots of things at you, but I suppose the same question as to John. Considering these major challenges, is digital health at the moment making an impact? And I suppose more fairly, do you think that it can actually begin to actually become a solution, not a whole solution, but part of a solution to some of those challenges?
Absolutely. So I think digital health is definitely helping with all the challenges that we've been facing with healthcare in India. So if you talk about access, right, getting access to healthcare, be it urban or poor, or the rural population, you always have a challenge to access to healthcare. So there are a lot of digital solutions or digital health solutions that are solving that purpose. People in the urban areas want to talk to a doctor remotely before they get to the hospital because it's an out-of-pay market. You don't always want to go to the hospital. You want to wait till it's a certain stage and then you want to consider going to a hospital. So to improve diagnosis, online consultation is helping, virtual consultation is helping. There are a lot of platforms that allow patients to post questions and get responses from doctors within a few hours, and they're free of cost, they're accessible, they're on your mobile phone, and it helps. When you talk about the same access problem with rural, they have no access to infrastructure. They probably have to travel to a nearby city, either a tier one or a tier two city, to get access. What we see happening there is very interesting because the digital health solutions are adding new stakeholders. So earlier we were talking about the ratio of doctors to patients in India, which is very low. So even if I insert technology into that equation, I still have very few number of doctors that have to answer questions digitally as well. So what some of the startups are doing, and it's working very well, is adding new stakeholders like health coaches and educators and diabetes educators into the mix, which are basically based out of your local communities and societies. And they are trained on these technologies. They're available to you on telephone. They're available to you on messaging. So they're they're helping the rural areas not just understand the diseases better, but also improve their access to healthcare. So they do the first assessment. In that way, the access is improving in rural healthcare as well. The third thing that's actually playing a huge role in getting digital health to scale in India is the intent of the government to truly use health technology to provide access and quality of healthcare to as many citizens as possible across India. So the most recent initiative, if you look at it, they're aiming to set up 150,000 health and wellness centers, which will be partially manned by technology and telecounseling, and then virtually connected to centers of care in tier one and tier two cities. So rural health centers are going to be a huge aspect of healthcare in India, providing access and both quality of healthcare to patients in India.
So when you talk about wellness, it's a bit of a bugbear of mine because I really don't like the term. But I mean, are you talking about preventative care, i.e. the idea of trying to instill in people a bit more information and knowledge to help change their behaviours a little bit to prevent illness? Or do you see
absolutely.
Well,
yeah. A lot of the efforts today are around awareness, because awareness in terms of cleanliness, awareness in terms of daily hygiene, mm-hmm. awareness in terms of healthy habits, in terms of what you eat, yeah. How much you eat, your exercise, your lifestyle habits, and all of that. If you look at the awareness piece in terms of preventative healthcare for urban, you can see the number of searches in Google. The access to information, patients are getting more proactive and informed around their own personal health. So there's a lot more control that patients are taking back and owning up their healthcare. In terms of preventative healthcare in rural, there was always a lack of awareness. There was always a lack of access to resources to understand basic things around your health. So through these technology and solutions and what we were talking earlier about rural health centers, manned partially by technology, there's an increasing amount of awareness around general healthcare in India, which I think meets the larger goal for the government as well.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I mean, wellness, I always feel, relates more to someone rollerblading in Santa Monica than it does to someone living in a village in rural India. But, you know, there you go. That is actually fascinating, actually. And I suppose how you deliver that, or not literally the specific programs that you're doing, because I wouldn't ask that, but I suppose the importance of pharma within that, not what pharma's doing itself, but how do you help support or partner or get involved with this ecosystem in across Asia, and I suppose...
So in pharma, I think we're doing a few things. Definitely, we're looking at some of the incumbent players, the new digital health players that are disrupting this ecosystem. We were talking earlier about adding new stakeholders into this ecosystem. So there are firms like 1MG, firms like Librate, which are young startups that have health coaches available for accessing... For simple questions, like mm-hmm. if you want to understand, if you just finish your consultation and your doctor wants you to use an insulin pen, mm-hmm. you would probably, instead of going back to the doctor, if you have a question, you can access a health coach. To your earlier point, Alex, about wellness, NCDs or non-communicable diseases in India are a huge burden.
Yeah, yeah.
So the whole digital health model in that space is playing a huge role as well. So access to reminders that will help mm-hmm. you understand why you should exercise, why you should measure your blood glucose, why you should do regular tests to understand your HbA1c. I know I'm going more and more into diabetes, but it's definitely one of the biggest burdens and definitely a lot more attention in terms of digital health in India. So as pharma, we are trying to understand the new demands of patients. Patients are definitely taking control, so we're trying to understand what they're looking for. If they're looking for information, we're trying to make information available to them easily accessible on their mobile phones. If they're looking for information around the product, around general disease areas, if that is a disease area that we are in, then we definitely play an active role in developing solutions to provide them access to both information and tools and resources.
I'm going to ask, that's really interesting, thanks, Jay. I'm just going to ask, I suppose, a bit of a cheeky question, but is a genuine thought that I have that when John mentioned going into a hospital and not seeing any old PC desktop computers and old tech, but seeing phones and laptops, and tablets, One, is there going to also be a leapfrog in some of the failures that we've had in the application of digital health in Europe? By that I mean that we've gone through a period where we thought that access to information was the most important thing, and of course we realised very quickly that that wasn't the case, that it was actually, really it's about behavioural change, and that we are emotional beings. We don't make rational decisions, but everything in health, virtually everything anyway, that is delivered to you is a rational piece of information or a reminder, which we also know doesn't work. So do you think there'll be an opportunity as well to move beyond the reminders, the information, the belief that people make rational decisions about their healthcare, and of the other word, which I hate, with the adherence thing, because the only people that talk about adherence are research professionals and pharmaceutical companies. And actually look at how you can help real people with this technology, or do you think that there'll have to be a move through
the same mistakes.
Yeah, the same. I remember once it was with my early days in an agency when we did a pitch where someone genuinely said to me, "We know what you're saying is the right thing to do, but we have to make the same mistakes everyone else does first." And it's like, well, okay, that's an interesting perspective. Yeah. but you know,
Darwin sorted those people out.
Yeah, that's true as well. But I don't know, either of you can take it. Do you think that there is an opportunity to leapfrog some of the things that have continually failed in your kind of regions and actually move to something a little bit more nuanced and around supporting people's behaviours and focused on outcomes? Kai,
well, I was going to say, it sounds like, you know, there's a huge opportunity for people getting access to health information and actually getting the resources they need. You look at digital therapeutics and the role they could play in these kind of spaces, even before, you know, pre-disease management and then disease management down that stream. Because it's in your hand. That's exactly what it's designed to do, is be there and be contextual. It sounds like there's a huge opportunity for that whole digital therapeutic. Mm-hmm. But the hardest part then is getting the reimbursement for those kind of products. Because, you know, there's a lot of cost involved in the development.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you maybe just want to ignore my question, which I totally get, but do either of you want to comment on that?
Well, we ignore Alex, so it's
Yeah,
fine.
It's fine. I'm used to it.
I don't think we... I don't think we can ever ignore you, Alex. no, you're asking a difficult questions. Look, I think it's why Joe and I exist, right? In Sanofi is to really take on these challenges of understanding how do we become a little bit more relevant within the system, and really, I think from my kind of regional level, what we try and do is try to practically solve problems for patients. And try practically to solve problems that are in the healthcare system. Technology itself is not the driver here. If we can't help, create, either a better life for patients in some way, or you know, we are solving problems within the healthcare system to be more sustainable, then we shouldn't really be doing this. So I sincerely hope we don't go through the same iterations of mistakes. I think there are some real things to consider when we are implementing these solutions in Asia. And I'll give you one specific example is a lot of the healthcare systems here are very much still led by what the doctor says. So the initiation point of digital health, where should it be? In Indonesia, for example, the universal healthcare coverage that they're covering called JKN is where everybody goes to register to get access to healthcare. So you start to think in your mind, where does the point of the journey begin around where these solutions should fit and how they should work within the system? So every system has its own nuances around that. So I think how we kind of look at it in Sanofi, I think today, certainly from my perspective, is that we look at it more like local problems around how do we help solve those problems within a particular country or a particular place, even different disease. Because some governments, as you said, Kai, are reimbursed. Some places, these solutions will never be reimbursed. So who's going to pay for them? It's probably going to be the patient or somebody else will have to pay. So this is really where it gets interesting is, if you have these different dimensions around, you know, who's eventually going to pay for it? Is it going to be insurance? Is it going to be us? Is it going to be the government? Then you might start to see different types of solutions or a different way that these things go to market for the patient as well. I'm not sure, Alex, I've answered your question, but I certainly hope we don't go through the same mistakes. But generally, how these markets work is very different in terms of how these types of applications and support programs are actually consumed.
Now you did answer my question. I think basically what you described there with regard to how you scale, with regard to who's going to pay for it, it sounds like a very commercial challenge, but I actually think it's at the root and at the heart of scaling digital health full stop. But you also added another person in there, as in, is it going to be a government that's going to pay? Is it going to be a health insurer that's going to pay? Is it going to be a person? And actually, if you forget about the payment bit and think about value and problem solving, that's the biggest challenge to most digital health companies. Is it of real value to the patient? Because most of the stuff that's out there adds to someone's burden. It's more things for them to do. The value is not explicitly obvious, especially if you're talking about preventative care. But even in managing chronic disease, governments, very few digital health solutions have shown any real return on investment with regard to cost effectiveness or actually even improving outcomes. And health insurers, well, I mean, it's different in different countries, but it's the same challenge with regard to, you know, proving return on investment, but there's also the preventative stuff in there as well, and very few solutions have got any evidence for preventing,
It goes back to the behavioural change component, though, doesn't it? Because, you know, if you're told you're close to becoming diabetic, you can either make a change or you could still have that Krispy Kreme donut, you know. You're not necessarily going to do that. You don't necessarily make the whole change. It's very few. I've seen people who've had heart attacks stop smoking, stop drinking overnight because of what it does to them. But then they slowly come back over time and they have the occasional drink once they've got lipids under control, etc. But really it comes down to the human and the behavioural change aspects and how much they want to take it on and drive their own behaviour. And if the person is in that pre-disease state, then the onus falls on them to manage it, because healthcare systems are designed to take it on when they fall into that stage.
I agree, and I think that was
That's the more costly aspect of it.
And I think that was my point earlier with regard to we've done a lot of things. We've provided a lot of rational information to people, and it doesn't work because people don't think rationally.
Yeah.
They make different calculations. It's not even a calculation, but they make different responses to that about how they manage their health and the way that they think about how they manage their health. And the second thing is the kind of reminding or telling people to do things. Again, it doesn't work. You add into it the vast cultural array that you have in Asia, the incredible speed that populations are growing and, you know, application technology is growing, and the massive divide, socioeconomic divide. There's a divide in the UK, there's a divide everywhere, but, you know, it's obvious in somewhere like India. You know, it's a hell of a challenge, and I suppose my point is if you get involved in rolling out the same stuff that we've tried to do in Europe, which has failed, then it's likely to fail harder and at a greater scale, in Asia. It's just my observation, but I could, of course, be...
Absolutely. So I agree with you, Alex. And to your earlier point about value, right? So the way, the basic is patients in India mostly is out-of-pocket market. So what is the value that they're looking for? And what is the value that most of these digital health players are trying to drive? If you look at the whole journey of the patient, the first one is basically to research for the doctor, research for your symptoms. So access to information is one. The second is trying to schedule an appointment. So there are a lot of tools these players are providing in terms of scheduling an appointment, because in India, the wait times for OPD consultation is really huge. So with the access to tools like scheduling appointments with doctors, to be able to see the ratings of doctors so that you can understand which doctor to visit, which doctor to consult, and the access to such information is really valuable. So it starts, value starts right from there. So in India, especially if you look at going back to the OPD wait times, if I can schedule an appointment and if I can go to the doctor without having to waste half of my day, that's a great value for me. The second would be outpatient service. Once I'm done with my doctor's appointment, e-commerce, especially in terms of e-pharmacies, are huge in India. So to be able to deliver those medications home, someone that is trained that will come to your home, deliver the medication, educate you a little bit about if there are any devices involved for you to use, and follow up with you periodically, that makes a lot of sense as well. So both e-commerce in terms of pharmacies and then telemedicine in terms of helping you stay on track with your medication is helping. Mm-hmm. So that's also a lot of value. So adherence and to digital therapy therapeutics, I think they come after all of this. So there is different layers of digital health that's happening in India. And I think digital therapeutics are just starting to emerge. I'm not sure if we will go through the same successes or failures that we've seen in the developed markets, though.
I think the only thing I would add, Alex, around this kind of motivation point is that we have to move beyond education and access to information. We've been doing it for a long time, and whilst it does play an important part for some, it doesn't necessarily motivate everybody to do anything. You know, if you tell someone with a chronic disease that they need to lose weight and they need to exercise every single day, they're not going to use your solution. So we have to design programs probably using different techniques and different understandings to get a bit of a different outcome. And you start to see, I've seen a few health tech guys out here start to think differently around more techniques that are probably used in other areas, you know, gaming and things like this around motivational design. How can I nudge people in a different way than before? How can I reward behavior? Not necessarily reward giving things, but rewards in terms of understanding, you know, what does this really then mean? So I think I start to see a difference with some players here, and I think this is critical that we don't always do what we've always done. As you know, I will go back to the point: how much disease education can you do on hypertension or on diabetes that people can ignore? You can do an awful lot, but what can you do in order to make a regime around disease management easy and you reward that behaviour? You can probably do a lot more, right?
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And I mean, digital therapeutics is a term cooked up by companies that call themselves digital therapeutics companies. The truth is that the reason that most of them have come out of CBT and CBT-derived mindfulness, which is great because there's a whole evidence base there, and you can obviously scale that through digital technologies because you can offer it to more people through, you know, their devices. But evidence for digital therapeutics in interventions beyond CBT is a different kettle of fish altogether. So I suppose my point there is that there's still a lot to be done with regard to building an evidence base in digital health. And obviously, I sound like a skeptic. I'm not at all. It's literally my job and my life. So I'm the opposite to a skeptic. But I think you've both made the point. You have to, wherever you are in the world, you have to start from a real problem that you're trying to solve for a real person, rather than kind of a theoretical position of trying to, you know, being particularly excited by technology. So we're nearly at the end, and it's been incredibly interesting. I've learned a lot myself. Final question, and you can take it wherever you would like, but what do you think needs to change going forward in order to deliver the things that you guys have set, and obviously have started to do? But
does it need to change?
Right, true. I mean, obviously it's a leading question, as it would be, but, you know, does it need to change? And if it does, what does need to change in order to make the most of the opportunities we have with digital?
So in terms of just digital health startups, I think the solutions that we're seeing a lot of frugal innovation, doing more with less in India. And I think the next step would be scaling up, because some of these models are really successful. But can they really scale up across India and provide solutions beyond the tier ones and the tier two cities? That's something. So I expect a lot more government partnerships probably will help there. There are definitely one or two digital health players that are already pursuing state government partnership, national government partnerships to take their solutions more deeper into India. So that definitely is something that should happen more. In terms of pharma, I think pharma is still trying to understand the whole new ecosystem, the demands of the patient and the doctor in terms of the new ecosystem. So I think, especially from a pharma's end, I believe innovation labs should work like startups, pick up the need of the patient and need of the doctor, solve for it, and work like a startup for about a year or two. So by which I mean, learn, adapt, and move in a really quick fashion, develop a business model and really scale it up eventually, because otherwise I don't think they will be able to figure out their role in the new ecosystem easily. And I think they will probably lose to competition that will do it.
That's really interesting. On this, working as a startup, as someone that's done three startups after leaving pharma, it always interests me when people within corporate environments say that. I mean, when you say work like a startup for the first year, do you mean not get paid as well? Or do you still get paid?
That's made in panic.
No, not that part. Definitely not that part.
Okay. So it's more.
You're assuming we get paid.
Sorry, Joe. I just couldn't resist.
He was clutching his heart when that was said.
I mean, the thing that came from that for me was the doing more with less. I think if we all had that philosophy with regard to where we start with digital health, it might be useful. John, what about yourself? You know, what needs to change, if anything?
I think there's a couple of things to consider, Alex, from my perspective. I think there are a lot of challenges around data that we have. You know, we've not touched on it an awful lot, but, you know, actually, how do we prove what we do works soundly? And then how does that feed back into a system? If there is a system, then how does that work? And how do we partner better with government and with startups and with players? Again, not everything's about the startup, right? It's really, you know, what impact we can have on the system. And I think for me, it's actually practically solving problems which are beyond what we've solved before. So again, you know, digital therapeutics is often around, you know, drug plus or whatever you want to call it. Actually, we need to think around what the pain points of the system are, what the pain points of the patient are, and which ones we are really able to help solve, and which ones we really have an obligation to solve as well, because we're part of that ecosystem and what is our role. And I think, to Joe's point, we're trying to figure out what our role is there, and I think we need to be super practical and try and figure out, you know, what pain points we can solve. So, for example, you know, if we want, you know, the big issue around chronic disease, then what data do we need, and how do we collaborate with governments in order to reward outcome for that with governments or with patients? And I don't have the answer, by the way, but these are the type of things that we really need to consider and think through around better disease management going forward, which is beneficial to all, right?
Yeah. In fact, the things you said there are something very close to my heart, which is how do we prove what works? As part of what I do, I've seen hundreds of presentations of digital health solutions, and the majority of them prove that they work by talking about usage data, not mapping intervention points to clinical and patient outcomes.
Yeah.
And a lot of the time as well, when you follow through the, for want of a better term, kind of journey of a company, they'll start off with usually observational studies, but observational studies with some form of clinical and patient outcome endpoint. And then when it comes to the time when they were going to be publishing, nothing exists. And you'll see that time and time again. So I think you're right, John. If you don't get the clinical patient outcome as part of the solution with the behavioural change and the value to the user, and then add into that, of course, the value to the healthcare system, if you can't tick those boxes, you don't have a viable solution. Yeah. But time and again, I see partnerships that Pharma is doing and digital health companies themselves that don't often tick two of those boxes. I think you're absolutely right.
Yeah, I just think to build on that, Alex, so as well, I think it's, you know, I think a lot of the data you see is obviously based off a small subset as well. I think success also comes in scale up and usage. I mean mass adoption, and then what really, how does it really work in the real world? I will avoid the real world evidence cliche, but literally, how does it work when it's out there? I think proving that it actually works and makes impact at scale, and I think that's yet to be. I don't know if it's being cracked, but certainly I think that's something that we should be very, very mindful of, is whatever we do, it has to move beyond a couple hundred patients or 1,000 patients here and there. It really needs to scale. Given the numbers that I started with, about 4 billion people in Asia, mm-hmm. how can we really have impact on patients' lives?
So true. And in fact, the other thing that comes out of looking at the way people are attempting to measure their solution is they'll often use a proxy endpoint and then make a correlation. So for example, they'll say, we know that in people that have received rehabilitation with COPD, that they make these levels of improvements, we have this online rehabilitation program, therefore we expect to see these levels of improvements. Well, that's okay as a hypothesis, but to your point, John, it's not okay with regard to expecting governments or health insurance companies or anyone to scale that across hundreds of thousands or millions of people. So, okay, yeah. So that's fantastic. So thank you so much for joining us. I think it's been really, really interesting. If people wanted to contact you, then I suppose you're available online, or are you not? Most definitely not available.
It depends. It depends what the question is.
It always does.
Of course, you can find me on the usual channel: LinkedIn, Twitter, maybe not Facebook, but yeah.
Yeah.
Same here. Preferably LinkedIn, but yeah.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Well, thank you so much. I know that we've probably not done the justice to, you know, to the topic with regard to not what you guys have said, but the time we've had, because it's such a massive topic and massively interesting. But thanks so much for joining us. If people want to follow us, and there's a whole list of things that we need to professionally say, which I never do. So Kai, can you remind me? So first of all, we have a LinkedIn group if you want to join that.
So we've got a LinkedIn group if you want to join that. Thank you, Alex, for the reminder.
We are... go on, you go for it. You go for it. So everything we need, that people need to know.
Everything we need to do. Make sure you like the podcast and share it with your friends and colleagues who would also find it interesting. You can message us through the LinkedIn group if there's any particular subjects that you want to hear about or talk about, or even if you're really keen to come and join us on the podcast, let us know, because we're always interested in having guests such as our good colleagues today. Other than that, hit the like button and upvote us. Come on, make us famous.
Right, Ruby. That's a bit of a stretch. But
infamous.
Okay, great.
I've been watching too many YouTube videos.
Well, thanks, Joe, for joining us from Mumbai. Thanks, John, from Singapore.
Yeah, big thank you.
And we'll see everyone again next time.
You're welcome, guys. Thank you so much for having us.
Thanks, guys.
Welcome to the Digitally Sick podcast.